Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for all the provisions that you have made for us in Christ. We recognize that from eternity past, you have factored us into your plan, that your plan is no afterthought, that you knew everything we would think, say, and do throughout our human history, and that you have made adequate grace provision so that we can continue to advance spiritually if we so choose. We recognize that the vast majority do not choose to do so because they are unwilling to submit themselves to the system that you have established, but that for the few who do, that you have the pure gold of Bible doctrine, even in these last days, for which we are grateful. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are here moving on with the next incident that Mark records. Again, very possibly this all could have been from chapter 2, verse 1 down through here. Could have all happened in a single day. We're not really told. Again, Mark is not seriously concerned, it doesn't appear, with chronology. He provides no chronological markers. And so when he does, it's rare, but he does occasionally, and that we can fix certain things. But when these events happened, at some level, is really irrelevant. The fact is that they are recorded accurately. This is, again, very much the view of Peter, that Peter was a great influence on Mark, and Mark appears to have been in Rome with Peter just prior to his death, and so appears to have been a companion of him at other times as well. So therefore, Mark records what Peter remembers, and again, not necessarily in strict chronological order, but it doesn't have to be that way. So with the other Gospels, we can see that some things are moved around, and that's fine, because this is just the way people remember and the way they tell stories. They don't necessarily move from point A to point B in strict chronological order. So the next event we have here, following the call of Levi, and this is the last mention we have of him calling anyone. There are only, at this point, five disciples, but we know by the time, if you look ahead into chapter 3, verse 16, which is not all that far off, by about a chapter, he's appointing the 12. And picks them out of a group of larger disciples. As we're going to see, there was a fairly large group of people. And that would change, but the complexion of the congregation, we might say, would change from time to time. Some would peel off as others would come in. The numbers tended to be getting larger. As we know, this creates at least a part of the basis for conflict with the religious leaders of Israel. But if you look ahead here, we have the 12 being appointed. Well, we've got no record of the other seven ever being called specifically, but we do know they are appointed here specifically by Jesus for a particular ministry. The inner 12, and even among the inner 12, as we will see, there was the inner circle, essentially, of Peter, James, and John. That doesn't mean that others were never around at all, but they seem to be the closest to Jesus. We're not really ever told why, other than some people more naturally fit together. Some people have a greater capacity for other people than they have for some other people. So whatever the reason, Peter, James, and John, again, Peter likely was one of the oldest of the disciples, if not the oldest. He was probably closer in age to Jesus than the others. And in fact, could have been older than Jesus. We're not, again, really ever told specifically how old Peter was, but he appears to be one of the few that was married at that time. Not that the others didn't get married, which they some of them did, as Paul points out. Peter kept his wife, and other members of the ministry had their wives with them. So we're not ever again really told exactly how long Peter's been married, any of that. Certain things we just have to recognize, okay, this is our limitation, and move on. But following the call of Matthew, and in response to that call, it seems to me very evident here, in response to that call, Matthew throws a giant party for Jesus and those who are associated with him. And we've looked at verse 15 in the exegesis. It happened that he was reclining. It came to pass that he was reclining at the table in his house. And again, they have rightly supplied here, I believe, the idea of at the table, because this is a formal dinner situation. And many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him. Again, a much larger group than, say, just the strict 12, And certainly much larger than just the four or five disciples, the five now, that we have seen called. Well, here we go. Again, another conflict. And it really, essentially, Mark records, beginning in chapter 2, five conflicts that set the stage for the rest of the book. He gets into this pretty quickly. He spends, as we've seen, a bare minimum of time describing the first year to year and a half of Jesus' ministry, and focuses here on the conflicts that ultimately are going to lead to his destruction with the religious leaders of Israel. And when the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" Well, I guess that's the big question now, isn't it? Why would Jesus associate with these people? And as we know the answer, although Mark doesn't ever necessarily spell it out, but we know the answer, and that is Jesus could see positive volition. Even under these guys, rough as they may be, rugged as some of them may have been, rough around the edges as they may have been, young as they may have been even, Jesus saw what others could not see. And he saw that many of these people were positive. At least at that point. Now, that's not to say they're going to remain positive. We know that people, some people can be positive for a period of time. That will be set forth for us very clearly in the parable of the soils, where some go along for a while and then they fall away. So positive volition is something that has to be maintained. You have to challenge yourself in order to continue to fulfill the royal imperatives of the Christian life, and to continue to do the right things. And the challenge is to do that. And you've got this inner conflict that is set up and that is not going to go away. That is because of the indwelling nature of the sin nature. You're not going to get rid of that before you die. It is going to be with you. Paul describes the angst of the positive believer as he comes under the sin nature in Romans chapter 7. He deals with that at length. And so these people are sinners, notorious sinners. They're the, in many cases, what people would consider to be the spiritual down and out. And not in Beverly Hills, here in Judea, or Galilee at this point. So he's eating with these people, he's socializing with them, and this scandalizes the religious leaders. And again, the scribes were essentially the strong arms, the legal enforcers for the Pharisaic form of religion. And it is just that. We make a distinction between religion and Christianity. Religion focuses on men and what they think they need to be doing. Christianity focuses on revelation from God. That we don't surmise, we don't guess, we don't ad lib. We recognize that God has revealed clearly in his word what he wants. And even when we fall short, we have to acknowledge, well, it's still true. It is what he wants. We may fail, and we may personally come short. Well, all of these people did as well. It didn't stop Jesus from associating with them. Now, obviously, there comes a point at which it becomes counterproductive to associate with somebody who's negative. That, obviously, you have to figure out as a believer. This is why we have the doctrine of separation, is so that you can be protected from people not only that are negative, but that are going negative, to have your guard up. And when they do, we are to maintain an attitude towards them of concern, but we distance ourselves from them. We let them know that in no uncertain terms, this is not acceptable. And if we have the opportunity, we should run into somebody, say, who's left Bible class or who's tanked it spiritually. Well, then the reality is you just give them the exhortations. We see there First Thessalonians. Where Paul says, look, you, some of you here, you won't work. Probably they had a problem in that particular church, although this was, by all standards, what we would call a model church. And guess what? The model church had problems too. So everybody who has these little religious stars in their eyes that I'm going to find the perfect situation, I'm going to get under the perfect teacher, well, good luck, because it's not going to happen. And you're going to take your STA with you, so even if you found the perfect church, you'd ruin it. So just, you know, hang out with them and you'll drag them down. Well, that's the whole point, obviously, is that Jesus sees what others can't see here. He sees that even in spite of these people's problems, and we have to make a distinction here between what we call incidental sinning and reversionism. And all of us sin every day. I mean, if you go through a whole day and you haven't sinned, you've really probably accomplished something. And then you have reversionism, which is obviously a far different deal. Because, and you can see the doctrine of reversionism. Incidental sinning is handled by rebound. You maintain positive volition and tenacity toward doctrine. You fail, you come up short, you rebound, and you get back with it. That's all you can do. But if you want to perpetuate it, you're going to go down what we call the glory road, as opposed to the glory road. You can maintain momentum up here, even through sinning. If we couldn't, we'd all be in trouble. We'd all be dead, I mean, because God would have to just take us all out. Well, he doesn't. But if a believer decides they're going to go this way, well, then that calls for a different tack on the part of believers toward that believer. They have to back off. They have to withdraw support. They have to let them know, hey, just as the Corinthian eventually, Paul basically tossed him from the church. Same with Hymenaeus and Alexander. They seem to have maintained their reversionism. And so what you have here is you have a situation where, say, in the incestuous Corinthian, whose sin was likely more shocking to people than Hymenaeus and Alexander's sins, they were just slightly perverting the teaching. Well, that's real important, obviously, because Paul tosses them for that in the first book of Timothy. But they don't appear to recover, and yet the incestuous Corinthian recovers. And so the doctrine of separation is designed to enforce on them the principle of lupe, and that there is a legitimate sorrow that one should feel when they fail and come up short. If you can just fail and come up short with impunity and it never bothers you, there's something wrong in your Christian life. It has to bother you. It should bother you. And so if you come up short, okay, and it bothers you, that's good. That means your conscience is still active. You haven't scarred it over. And one of the things we'll be doing, I'll be updating a doctrine of the hardening of the heart or scar tissue of the soul and how people get into this. Well, the scribes of the Pharisees see he's hanging out with these people and they're scandalized by this. Because these are the types that they avoid it at all costs. And this gets into another kind of fundamental issue in regards to Christianity. If you're not ever going to get your hands dirty, how are you ever going to help anybody? Because let's face it, I remember when there was this one guy, he was getting a church. I won't say which one it was, but he was getting a church, doctrinal church. And I remember when they went and candidated for it, his wife comes back, and I mean, she looks at me with just this grief-stricken, horrified look on her face and said, "They're fundies." I said, "Well, what'd you expect? They've been run through the ringer by these goofballs over the years." And this was a church that at one time had a pretty sound doctrinal teacher, and then he began to go south spiritually. And the church went through this like 10 or 12 or 15 year period, however long it was, where they just floundered around under different weirdos. And then finally, apparently there's a core of positive volition there, and they said, you know, we've got to get a good teacher. And so they finally did. But that's the whole point. When you, as we're going to see here, Jesus' statement coming up in verse 17, it's not the healthy that need a physician. It's those that are sick. Who has ever heard of a doctor that refused to see sick people? Well, it's not much of a practice. Even if he is practicing, it's not much of one. So here we have this situation set up where these people are scandalized. Why? Because they can't see what Jesus sees. So we have here Chi, the connective. They've translated that one actually as when. In this case, they've translated it with a temporal force. The scribes is a grammatus, G-R-A-M-M-A-T-E-U-S. This is, we get the Greek grammar, comes from the R word, grammar. Gramma means a letter, and so this was a guy who dealt with letters. The scribes who kept track of the minutiae, as it turns out, not only of the Mosaic law, but the minutiae of the Pharisaic system, which had been superimposed over the Mosaic law. The scribes of the Pharisees, and this is a kind of an odd construction. As a matter of fact, this is the only place you'll see scribes and Pharisees. But here it really links them, this genitive of relationship here, that they are seen in close proximity to the Pharisees. And in fact, as we're going to see, they are the people who we enforce the Pharisaic system. And so these two groups are, in a sense, intertwined throughout the scriptures. The scribes of the Pharisees, Pharisaios, that word literally means the separated ones. Pharisaios. And so these people tended to, the people kind of looked upon them because they tended to remain separate. So they took the doctrine of separation and they mangled it all to hell because they weren't applying it the way it was meant to be applied. Separation is designed to be applied in serious situations. They separated themselves essentially from everybody. So as Jesus points out, their position is kind of inconsistent. If you are a great religious leader, why aren't you out there helping the people that have needs? And obviously this has to be done in the proper context and understood, but they were unwilling, and that gets into the whole fundamental issue. It isn't just that they didn't do it, they were unwilling to do it. They deemed themselves better than others. We see this repeatedly. We saw it in that parable of the two men that went to pray. The Pharisee stood and prayed with himself, "I thank you, Lord, that I am better than everybody else. I have no needs. I am as righteous as they come. And Lord, you're lucky to have. I don't even know why I'm talking to you. I'm that good." Well, that's the Pharisaic motto, essentially. That's their method of operation. So the scribes of the Pharisees saw, aorist active participle, having seen literally, once, and that's actually why they translate the chi here as when, because they've taken this as a temporal participle. Once the scribes and Pharisees saw this, then it breaks loose. And they saw that. Conjunction hati here introduces the content of what they saw. This is provided, or here translated, saw that. They've actually translated it as that here in the New American Standard. Normally, sometimes it'll be just with quote, but this introduces what they saw, that they are eating. Literally, he is eating. Present active indicative third person singular of the verb to eat, the simple verb estio. Estio. With preposition meta, which denotes accompaniment, that they are eating with the sinners. Again, the sinners are not necessary. Hamartalos here are not people who are morally bankrupt. These are people who the Pharisees have deemed to be sinners. And how have they deemed them to be sinners? They've deemed them to be sinners because they won't submit themselves to the Pharisaic system. They won't study all the details. They don't make any efforts to apply all the rigorous things that the Pharisees put on people. And so they're viewed by the Pharisees as cursed. They're viewed as cursed because they're ignorant. And see, and once again, the Pharisaic arrogance comes out. These people, short of it, is they're ignorant, and so they're just viewed as sinners, people to stay away from. Sinners and telones, tax collectors. T-E-L-O-N-E-S. And that word means exactly that, the tax officer. They were saying, the imperfect active indicative here, again, the imperfect is significant because this is not just a single attack. Sometimes when you read it, say in the English, they saw he was eating, they said to his disciples, well, particularly the New American Standard has translated this like it's a simple aorist. They were constantly doing this. They were constantly badgering his disciples. One of the things we'll see is when they have complaints about Jesus is they badger the disciples. When they have complaints about the disciples, they badger Jesus. They never seem to go to the person with whom they have the problem. So the imperfect here is significant, and the force of lego here is to complain. It's not just they're saying it. They're complaining to his disciples. They're bitching at him about it. They're carping at him. And they keep carping at him. But obviously, Jesus will take care of this. And he becomes aware of it, certainly. To his disciples is the dative masculine plural of mathetes. Again, a disciple, a student, a learner. And again, the term comes to have a religious significance in that it comes to mean one who's attached themselves to a particular teacher. And there's nothing, that is a neutral concept, neither good nor bad. Everybody finally follows somebody else in the end. I mean, they may follow their own arrogant thought processes, but they're following something. You're either going to have a teacher or you're going to become your own teacher, your own pastor. Well, if you do that, you're in real trouble. Because it can't effectively be done by a sheep. And so the disciples of him, genitive of autos here. Why is he eating? And you've got here Hadi, which is actually still introducing indirect discourse. They were saying, they've translated it as a question here, but they see that and they are saying it is essentially what's happening. There is no real question here in the Greek. They were saying that, and this is their complaint, he's eating with the wrong types of people. Now, we cannot have this. He said, they were saying that with tax collectors, again, preposition meta, in accompaniment with telones, again, and hamartalos, again, hamartalos, he is eating, present active indicative. And hearing this, Jesus said to them, and is Kai here, having heard this literally, or after he heard this, you've got again a temporal use of the participle akouo, to hear. Having heard the Jesus, the subject here, the nominative case of the Iesus, he says, present active indicative of lego, the simple verb to say, to them is autos. And again, this is addressed to the fault finders first, but by implication, there's a larger audience that's going to hear this. Now, they may not have all heard the Pharisees carping at the disciples, but they hear what Jesus says. So he says to them that, and again, Hadi here introduces indirect discourse, and they've translated it here by the quotation marks. That's one of the ways they'll do this. Negative ou here, it, not a need, literally, having. And this is a Greek idiom that simply means that there is no need for something. So you could translate it just like that. There is no need for the healthy to have a physician, literally. There's no need for the healthy people to go see a doctor. And typically speaking, you find out that's true. Most people don't go to the doctor if they're healthy and they feel good. They go to the doctor because they're sick. Something goes wrong. So negative ou plus this word is cryo, C-H-R-E-I-A. And that word means to be lacking in something, to have a need, to be short, having present active indicative of echo, the simple verb to have. And then you've got this word, this present active participle, ischuo, I-S-C-H-U-O, and that's got the definite article with it. And so the word literally means to be strong or to have power. So it refers to a class here. They use the participle to refer to a particular class of people. And in context here, the strength means, you know, you're in good physical health. You're healthy. And that's how they've translated it here. Not a need having the healthy for a physician, or of a physician. Actually, you've got the genitive here of iatros. I-A-T-R-O-S. And that word means a physician or a doctor. The verb hiaomai means to heal. And so the idea is a healer. And that's what doctors are supposed to be. But, strong adversative here to set up the contrast, Allah. But the ones having ills, we might say. The ones being sick. You got the ones having, again, present active participle with the definite article of echo. And then this adverb, kakos. K-A-K-O-S. Kakos, the adjective, means evil or bad. And kakos means to be badly, literally. It's an adverb. So the ones having badly is a literal translation, which is not smooth English at all. So what they've got here in the New American Standard does reflect the sense of what the Greek is getting at. It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. And so here they've translated ills as sick in context, which is good. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. I did not come as negative ou plus the simple verb erkomai, to come. To call is kaleo, K-A-L-E-O. And that is, again, a purpose infinitive. I did not come for the purpose of calling righteous people. Dikaios. Now, one of the things you're going to have to figure out, obviously, and we should all already know, hopefully, and that is views of righteousness really differ. What is righteousness? Well, very shortly, the short definition, righteousness is being right. Now, how do you know how and when you're right? Well, clearly the one standard, the objective standard we have is the Scripture. Everybody, personal views of how right we are or aren't are subjective. And they will always be subjective. Because we the human being, as we all know, has an amazing capacity to overlook his own shortcomings. And we've all done it. We all do it. And so here, what is the righteous? Well, see, the scribes and Pharisees would have said, we're righteous. We're right before God. God accepts us. And Jesus said, no, he doesn't. Well, obviously that is going to create a conflict as well. So I did not come to call righteous. And in this context, this would refer to those people who thought they were righteous by virtue of their external observances of religion, the religion of the Pharisees. And so they thought they were righteous. They thought, God's in this. We've got all these laws and we keep them, and God's in this and I'm righteous. And Jesus said, well, I didn't come to call that kind of person that already thinks they're righteous, that already believes they are. But sinners, and in this context, obviously it sets up as opposite of those who are righteous. But sinners, those who are not right. The good thing is, obviously, as we find out, that as believers, we look back. I don't look back at my pre-salvation state and say, oh, you know, I was really a righteous person. I really had it together. No, I was horrible. I was God, as bad as I may be now. You think, well, you haven't improved much. Well, I have. You just didn't know me then. I was a fairly nasty individual. You say, well, let's not get into what I am now. That's not the point. But the fact is, these types of people who recognize their faults, their flaws, their shortcomings, this is what God's looking for. All right, point one here. Given the reputation of tax collectors at that time in Israel, it makes a little difference whether Levi was operating legally and not extorting money from those he taxed, or whether he was just as bad as others in that profession. And again, when you deal with professions, it's easy to lump them all together and say they're all bad or they're all good. That's not true. There's exceptions to every rule. So if he was operating according to the normal realm of that day, he was skimming money. Well, we don't know if he was or not. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was a righteous tax collector. We're just not ever told. Well, too, the prevailing view was that he was part of the dregs of society. And even the call of Jesus would not have changed the widespread view of tax collectors. This isn't, Jesus calling Matthew here, or Levi is his given name, wasn't going to change people's minds necessarily. These attitudes were highly entrenched in Israel at this time. It's in the attitudes towards the tax collectors and how bad they were. And again, they represented, to some extent, a foreign government, foreign power, foreign domination. So they've got, forget just the taxing thing, which nobody likes. But then you're being taxed. I mean, can you imagine if we were invaded and we ended up with Mexican or Canadian tax collectors who were not part of the indigenous population, but were sent in and, extorted money out of people and all that. Well, yeah, that's what these people are going through. Three, in fact, from the human viewpoint, Jesus Christ had nothing to gain and a lot to lose by associating himself with Levi. Four, the introductory formula, chi genetai, and it became or it came to pass, is used regularly in the Septuagint to translate the Hebrew conjunction and the verb haya, to become. And that's how normally they'll translate it in the Old Testament very often by the phrase, and it came to pass. And it just moves you into, it's telling you something has changed. And from the call of Levi, it looks like to me not any time really elapses. And by that evening, whatever time it was when he got his call, he has prepared this large meal and with Jesus as the guest of honor. Well, five, the first portion of verse 15 has been recognized as being ambiguous, since the pronouns are not clearly identified and form the basis for some debate. Well, six, however, we have the parallel passage in Luke, which provides further explanation. And the rules of hermeneutics insist that the passage, the principle is that the clear passage takes precedence over the obscure. And so this is true simply just when you're dealing with the Bible. But if you're ever trying to put together a doctrine, you have to cite clear passages to prove your point. And over the years, I've seen some doctrines, and a guy would cite a verse, and I would think, that doesn't have anything to do with his point. Why is that verse even there? Well, hermeneutically here, we've got Luke 5:29 that we can compare this with. And it says, and Levi gave a big reception for him in his house. And there was a great crowd of tax collectors. Now, the him has to be identified. One could argue, well, in Luke, it's still somewhat obscure. But as you see in the New American Standard, they've translated it with a capital H here. And the him comes grammatically and can be proven here from verse 28, the near antecedent. Levi gave a big reception for him. For who? Who is him? The last him is the him in verse 28 that Levi now follows. So clearly you can point out and prove, well, this is Jesus. And so Levi is throwing the dinner, and Jesus is the guest of honor. So 7, therefore, since Jesus is viewed as reclining in the house of Levi, it certainly appears that Levi threw a party with Jesus Christ as the guest of honor. This was another thing that Bug describes in the Pharisees. Jesus partied too much. Jesus was not like John the Baptist. He was, in fact, the opposite. John was very much an ascetic. He lived off in the wilderness by himself, lived this very rigorous, austere lifestyle where he just lived off the land and didn't socialize with people to speak of. I mean, he would deal with them when they came out there, but John wasn't running around looking for social life or going to parties or any of that. And Jesus is just the opposite. Jesus does just the opposite. Jesus is very outgoing. Jesus associates with people regularly. And some, when you get into this, sometimes you'll ask, well, you know, why did he associate with these people? Why did he do this? Well, he always had his reasons. And you just have to trust that the Son of God knows what he's doing. Because he'll go attend, you know, and obviously not, one of the things we'll find out in here, is that not all the scribes and the Pharisees were equally hostile. There were exceptions even within that group. There were moderate voices, no doubt. I mean, we're not always introduced to who the moderate voices were. And there were some that maybe even withheld judgment. They weren't sure. That seems to be the case, say, of Nicodemus. He's one of the rulers of the Jews in John 3. He gets his private audience with Jesus at night. Well, see, clearly he hadn't made up his mind yet. He was withholding judgment, and he'd heard certain things, and probably had heard Jesus teach and wanted to know more. Well, church history, essentially, you know, history, suggests that Nicodemus became a believer because we see him later on involved with Jesus. Now, he didn't quit his position as a leader of Israel, though, which is, you know, obviously there's a huge conflict at some level that Nicodemus would have to work through. And that conflict obviously will be solved for all of them at 70 AD. They don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, 8, although some have seen this dinner as a sort of retirement party for Levi, it seems more likely that this was a dinner Levi threw in order to introduce his friends, family, and associates to Jesus. Jesus obviously is popular. He's got a reputation, as we know. When people hear that he's in the area, they flock to that area. And so here is a chance to get, you know, up close and personal with a celebrity. So this is what Levi does. He makes Jesus accessible to these people. And Jesus complies. Jesus doesn't say, I can't come and eat at your house. You're a filthy tax collector. Obviously, because of the call, he sees something in Levi that other people do not see. 9 here, actually. I skipped one here. Mark does not spend any time introducing the event. He simply begins with the explanation that Jesus Christ was present in Levi's house and was eating with tax collectors and sinners. 10, the Jewish custom was to eat sitting up, but the Greek and Roman style of eating involved reclining on couches around a central table. And 11, although this custom may not have been in wide use in Palestine at that time, it appears to have been used for more formal or elaborate meals. And Luke informs us that this was a large banquet. which had many guests in attendance. I didn't cite that, but that's in Luke 5 again. And here Luke calls it, in verse 29, a big reception. And there was a great crowd. Mark at least says there were many. And so it's not as though they're in disagreement. Mark just is more brief, and that tends to be his style, though. He's more terse and doesn't develop some of these things as much as other people do, say Luke and Matthew even. So there's again, and they've supplied in verse 29 in Luke as well, reclining at the table. They understand this as a giant formal reception, a dinner, for what we might call a visiting dignitary. So Luke informs us it was a large banquet which had many guests in attendance. 12, given these facts, it is evident that Levi had done quite well financially, since a dinner of this size would require a very large room and a good deal of food and drink. And one of the things, of course, when showing hospitality, some people have it down better than others, and when you show hospitality, you don't want to run out of food or wine. I mean, that is a social faux pas. You just don't do that. I remember, of course, we were kind of poor back then, but I remember when I was a fundy, this young couple that had been in the same church there with us, they invited us over to eat, and you know, we went to their house and eat, and the portions were so small, and there wasn't really enough food. I mean, we ate everything they set before us. And then we went out and stopped at Taco Bell on the way home because we were still hungry. Well, obviously, Matthew has this down. He knows how to do this, and he's doing it right. So this party is expensive. And I'm surprised that the Pharisees weren't carping about that. Well, look how much money he spent on this. Well, there's times to spend money and to have an elaborate affair like this. And it's not every day, obviously. It's not all the time. But it's appropriate at times, and this is one of those times when it's appropriate. Later on, they will carp about it, not the Pharisees, actually his own disciples, led by Judas, will carp about the waste of money that they see happening. Well, as Jesus points out, you don't have the bridegroom with you very long, so you might as well enjoy the party while we're here. And that essentially is Jesus' kind of motto, that's his M.O., how he operates, is the bridegroom's here, and he was the bridegroom. And so he understands this in its full force. And Jesus never tells these people, oh, don't do any of this for me. He doesn't say, oh, that's inappropriate. No, this is a large banquet hall. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of people having fun. I'll bet you money there's somebody there that's drunk. Bet you money. And as we'll see, people, you know, these types of situations, and Jesus went into it and he never failed. I mean, he could drink and he stopped drinking, didn't get drunk, but he could drink and he drank his limit. And that was one of the things they carped at him about. Well, you're a wine bibber and a friend of sinners. Oh, and a glutton. He ate too much, too. That's what I like to do. I like to sit around and judge people while they're at parties and see, you know, what they eat, how much they drink. No, that's not in my business. And so here, I'm surprised they didn't carp about this, but they didn't. But Matthew has, again, done this right under the principle of hospitality. Well, 13, Levi does what is and has been common among those that have been introduced to the truth, either phase one or phase two truths. He contacted his friends, family, and others in his possession to join him for dinner so they could meet Jesus. And 14, although it is not unusual for those that hear the truth and accept it to want others to hear and accept it also, the fact is that most are not as enamored with the truth as positive volition is. And they're not. I remember when I first got saved, I thought, well, everybody's going to want to be saved. No. As a matter of fact, they, you know, people were, as it turns out, I found out how hostile they were to the gospel as I began to share it with them. You think, well, you'd want to be saved and get out of that whatever lifestyle you were in, because I tended to be hang out with the down and outers. And so you think people want to be saved? No. And then I get on doctrine, and I'm really excited because I've been a fundy for like 6 years by that time, or five anyway. And actually, no, it was longer than that. It was probably, I was 6 years or so. And I was getting very frustrated because I knew I wasn't being fed, and I was literally pastoring a church at that time, and I couldn't even feed myself. Now, that's always fun. Why is the cork on the fork? He has an eating problem. I couldn't feed myself, and yet here I am running this church. Well, then I get the doctrine, and I start hearing it, and I think, yeah, this is, God, everybody's going to want this. So I started sharing it with all my friends who were believers, and they all said, thanks, but no thanks. Pass. Not interested. And they had all various reasons, you know, why they weren't interested. I had one guy who was really sad because this was a really good friend of mine at that time. And we were very, very close. He was as much of a brother as anybody I'd ever had friends with. And we spent a lot of time together and we saw things all very much the same way. And he listened to the same doctrine I listened to and said, well, I hear it and I know it's true, but my wife will never go for it. And so we parted ways, and that was it. Never saw him again. He said, she just won't go for this. So you think, well, okay, I got the truth here. People are really going to want it. No, not necessarily. So 15, the most important feature and cause of controversy here is recorded next. It involved not only the numbers of people that were present, but the types of people. 16, the association of tax collectors and sinners is found in the other Gospels as well. And both classes were despised by the Orthodox Jews. We see that phrase used, say, in Matthew 11:19. And I think that is... that's not the parallel here, but this is a little bit later. And this is the passage to which I was referring. And Jesus points out that these people are just like stupid little children out playing. And he won't play our games. Well, Jesus wasn't into playing their games, and he wasn't going to play their games. And that's essentially what they're doing. They're whining. He said, what are you like? How shall I compare this generation? Verse 16. It's like children sitting in the marketplace who call out to other children. And they say, we played the flute for you, but you wouldn't dance. Mom, he won't dance. I played the flute. He's not dancing. Make him dance, Mom. And so, you know, that's the way kids are. The kids will have these little deals. He won't pay attention to me. He won't play with me. Well, go play by yourself. You know, but no. And so we sang a dirge and you didn't mourn. We played a happy song and you wouldn't dance. We played a sad song and you didn't cry. What's wrong with you, Jesus? For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. This was their final take on John the Baptist. Now, they would never come out and say this publicly. Jesus pulls the cloth back here and exposes these people for what they really are. They're not going to criticize John the Baptist publicly because they know he's held in high regard by the masses. And this becomes a problem for them with Jesus as well because they know he's held in high regard by the masses, so they can't really afford to give too much verbal and public, verbalize their hatred of him publicly. They have to walk kind of a tightrope on this. But the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And they say, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. And yet wisdom is vindicated by our deeds. And what we have here is what Jesus said. Essentially, God sent you two very different men, both within God's directive will, both declaring to you the way of righteousness, and you rejected them both. Well, there isn't really any hope for that. And I've seen people over the years where they have, you know, they get sideways with a pastor or something. And then they think, well, I'll go sit under some other pastor and I'll be happier there or whatever. And then they don't make it there. I mean, that's unfortunately, sadly, that's the way it usually goes. Well, what's the problem? The problem lies with the person. And I'm not ever saying that there's never a time for a person to change from one pastor to another. There may be. There's obviously some legitimate reasons why one would. But if one does it with the attitude of, this guy's, I don't like his authority and I'm going to go here, well, you're going to just be dealing with another pastor with authority anyway. And no matter how they come across, you know, you can find, say, well, I'll go for the guy whose personality appeals to me the most. Well, that may or may not be good. That may not be what God's will is. Well, and you can also see Luke 15:1, where he's, this is one of the carps against him, that he associates with the wrong types of people, and the wrong types, and by their estimation, are these tax collectors and sinners. These poor, uneducated Jews who just wouldn't toe the religious line for them. Verse 15, chapter 15, verse 1, now all the tax collectors and the sinners were coming near to listen to him. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. Well, thank God. What kind of Messiah have we got? Well, one that doesn't like sinners. Uh-oh. We're in trouble. since we're all sinners, it's going to be a real problem. But see, that was the Pharisees. They were self-righteous. They didn't see themselves as being sinners. They were overtly squeaky clean. Well, 17, the collection system that allowed the tax collector to extort money from the populace, which all allowed him to make an exorbitant profit at the expense of the citizen, led to intense hatred of these individuals. Add to that the fact that they worked for a foreign government, and this resulted in a situation where the tax collector was not only despised, but ostracized as well. And 19, therefore, for Jesus Christ to be associating with this type of person was bad enough. But for him to be dining freely with sinners only added to the stigma. And 20, the term sinners does not refer to those that were only guilty of morally violating the law of God. It was used also as a derisive term by the religious leadership to refer to those that were regarded as inferior because they did not adhere to the religious traditions. And traditions, by the way, also bear in mind, traditions is another one of those neutral things, like guns. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. And you could get rid of all the guns and people would still kill people. They'd find a way to do it. I saw part of it this morning. It was an old Saturday Night Live, and there was a skit on there where this guy, these girls are on vacation, and they're in Spain, and they're living it up, and it's exciting. And he said, well, I want you to come to my villa for a few days, and we'll drink a lot of food and have some good wine, and at the end of it, I will kill you. So he got out his little bottle of poison to show them that he was serious. So you could get rid of all the guns, and then people would still kill people. You cite that as a humorous example. You can kill people with a knife. You can probably kill them with a fork. You can probably kill them with a spoon. You know? And it reminds me of the old Monty Python thing, you know, come at me with a banana. I suppose you could kill people with bananas if you set your mind to it. Cramming up bananas down, they get into potassium overload, and who knows? I don't know. So, again, the idea here is that traditions are neither good nor bad. They're benign in themselves and of themselves. They're neutral. A tradition is good if it's right, but it's bad if it's wrong. And that's the whole thing, because Paul talks about, you know, you hold fast to the traditions that you've received from us. And he talks about like that like it's a good thing. Well, it is a good thing. There are good traditions and there are bad ones. It just depends on what the tradition is. If it's a tradition of men that men have enforced and all of that, well, then it's bad. And Mark will record that. Jesus ostracizes them for this, that they hold to the traditions of men. There are good, sound, biblical traditions that, like face-to-face teaching, and the local church. And I mean, these things are clearly taught, but there's a certain way we go about things. So again, traditions are not either good or bad. They're neutral. It just depends on what they are. Well, 21, although it would have included those that were guilty of overt morally sinful activity, it was broad enough to include those that did not scrupulously observe the legal regulations placed on them by the Sadducees, Pharisees, and scribes. The Pharisees were the predominant ringleaders in all of this. The Sadducees tended to be more amoral, and they tended to be, they weren't as, quote, overtly worried about compliance with religion and all of that like the Pharisees were. But they had a great deal of influence in Israel because they largely ran the whole principle of the high priesthood. And so they had the Sadducees were the ones who were profiting probably the most from the temple and all of that, and what came out of that. Well, 22, the term became technical for those people the Pharisees regarded as being of lesser value. The phrase, the people of the land, was used as a designation for those who did not take the time and make the effort to regulate their conduct by the legalistic observances of the scribes and Pharisees. And 23, therefore, anyone keeping company with these types of individuals was immediately suspect in the eyes of the religious leadership. And another whole thing here, too, that I don't know that it comes out in this particular passage, but a rabbi, a teacher, if you claim to be a teacher, these people were off limits to you, period. And so what kind of, quote, rabbi are you guys following? That would have been the Pharisaic attitude about Jesus. He's not much of a teacher, is he? And this comes across, this will come across through several stories, and I don't know that all of them are recorded in Mark, but for instance, one of the things, there's this one deal where Jesus is at somebody's house and reclining, and this woman comes up and opens this bottle of expensive perfume and then begins to wipe it on him with the hair of her head. And she's a hooker. Well, this would scandalize a lot of people. Like some hooker shows up here and starts, you know, rubbing her hair all over me. What are you going to think? You're going to think, wow. You'd be scandalized. And these people were scandalized. And this one guy sitting there thinking, he says, if he knew what kind of woman this was, he wouldn't let her near him. But Jesus saw, again, what others could not see, and that was her positive volition. She knew she was bad. She knew she needed help. She knew she was sick. The Pharisees didn't. They just thought, well, we're well. We don't really need you. If the sick people recognize that, hey, I need a doctor. I'm sick. Well, again, these people, anybody who claimed to be a teacher and associated with these types of people, well, he was immediately suspect. Well, he couldn't be a very good teacher. Couldn't be a very good rabbi. Well, 24, Jesus is not only present at the party, he brings his disciples with him, which is a term that refers to the members of Jesus' inner circle. The number of which we do not know for certain, but there were five at least. We know of five. He'd probably already called the others by now, but we can't necessarily prove it. So he did call them at some point. Well, 25, the term will be used in a limited sense to refer only to the 12. But will be expanded to refer to those that were regular companions of Jesus, which included men and women that accompanied him as he traveled. That is how it is to be understood in our verse. There's a pretty big band of disciples, we might say, that are with him now. Obviously, the inner five are there, and maybe the others have been called by now, and they're there. But this is a pretty large group of people following him, and people who appear to have attached themselves to him. So Matthew 10:1, we see it used there, only of the 12. Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits. To cast them out and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. And then in 12:49 of Matthew, there's a large crowd here. From verse 46, he's speaking to the crowds, and his mother and his brothers were outside trying to speak to him. And somebody tells him, hey, your family's here. And Jesus answered the one who was telling him and said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward his disciples. Well, in this context, it's a whole large crowd of people. There's a bunch of people there, not just the 12 in this case. Behold, he said, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother. So again, you've got a fairly large group of people following Jesus in a sense of that they've attached themselves to him. Again, for how long, we're not, that number's going to change and come and go. It isn't always going to be the same amount of people. Well, 26, the term mathetes first refers to one that engages in learning by being instructed by another. And the simple root meaning is a pupil or a student. 27, it came to mean one that attached himself to a particular teacher and learned and embraced the doctrines that teacher taught. And that is a disciple. And so, in this case here, 28, the end of verse 15 makes it clear that there was a sizable group that had attached itself to Jesus Christ and who were following him. Now, we're not told they're all strictly adhering to the teaching or anything like that. But there is a sizable group that's out there. And our time's up, so we'll stop here. And let's take our normal 20-minute break, and we will pick up here at 5 after.